For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Thank you all for coming on this Labor Day weekend. We're very happy to be starting our monthly Peace and Environment Forum series. We have one already scheduled for next month. There are flyers about all of our events in the front. We're very lucky to have with us today Laurel Ross, who happens to also be a regular practitioner here, but is the director of urban conservation for the Field Museum, and is going to talk today about Chicago as a wilderness, which is wonderful. So thank you very much, Laurel.
Thank you. I was just sitting here thinking I wish I had had the idea of bringing a native plant for our altar today, but maybe another day. Wilderness is sort of an evocative word, and I'm going to use it in a few different ways as we talk today, and I'll try to make it clear which way I'm using it. But just in the last half an hour, I took a little walk around the block to clear my head, and I noticed little pieces of wilderness just within a couple of blocks of here. People have dug up their horrible chemical-dependent water-sucking lawns and put in lovely native flora and other flora. That's different from the kind of more pristine wilderness that would be a natural ecosystem with some functions that we could talk a little bit about. But I think they both are worthy of this lovely term wilderness. So I'd love to be informal today. I do want to cover a few things, but please feel free to either speak up or raise your hand or whatever you're most comfortable with. I'll do this in three parts. I do want to talk about our landscape, the landscape that we're part of here. And I want to talk a little bit about its history and its condition. And then I want to talk a little bit about conservation efforts in this region, both sort of the level of agency and institution, like the one that I work for, and also the kind of conservation efforts that people like us do on weekends and evenings when we are participating in interacting with this landscape in a positive way. And then last, I'd like to just tell you about a few really special places. Some very close by here, some a little farther away, all of which are really wonderful places to be part of, to visit if you haven't visited. I'd love to entertain ideas from you of places that are special to you that you might like to share with others as well. So I made a little bibliography yesterday in a big rush, the way all of us do, many of us do most things these days. And you should each have a copy of that. It's not in any way comprehensive. In fact, many of those things are probably familiar to you. I was trying to give you an idea of sort of where I'm coming from, the kinds of things that I'm thinking about and want to refer to today. Couple of important ones that I left off that I just wanted to mention. There is a quarterly magazine that anyone can subscribe to for some small amount of money, like $16 a year, called Chicago Wilderness, and there's a few copies in the kitchen that you can look at, but it has all kinds of information about our natural areas in this region, and also ideas of things to do, and stories about people that are doing wonderful things, so I thought that would be an interesting thing to tell you about. And many of you probably know about a national magazine called Orion, which is another important thing that if I had my wits about me yesterday, I would have put on this bibliography. And I'm going to add to this, and I'll share it with Tygon. And if anybody wants the references, I can give them to you. And lastly, this one's a little obscure, but it's really wonderful. And it's called Hunting for Frogs on Elston. And, it's a collection of essays written by a dear old friend who is no longer alive, Jerry Sullivan, who for many years wrote a column in The Reader called Field and Street. And they were collected in this, and many, many, many lovely, and they're all 2,000 words because that's what the columns were for the newspaper, so they're an easy read. Just when you want to read something funny, I just open it up randomly and it says, fireflies, why they flash. So stuff like that. So those are just three things that aren't on this. I wanted to start out, though, by reading, I'm not going to read a lot today, but I want to start out by reading something while you're still fresh. because I think probably the most important thing I wanted to convey and sort of share with you is my feeling of how important it can be to really connect with a particular place. And we live in a wonderful place. This book by Scott Russell Sanders, he oddly grew up in northeastern Ohio, which is where I grew up. Not too many people I run into grew up in northeastern Ohio. He, like me, is no longer living there. He's permanently, or I guess impermanence is what we talk about here, but he's for a long term living in southern Indiana. And he wrote this book about making a home in a restless world, staying put. And he says it so much better than I could, so I'm just going to read a couple sentences from here. I aspire to become an inhabitant, one who knows and honors the land. I follow various and sometimes crooked paths, yet I'm always driven by a single desire, that of learning to be at home. The search is practical as well as spiritual. Only by understanding where I live can I learn how to live. What can be seen from my window, what can be reached on a foot within a day's walk of my house, may seem tame enough. No surf breaks on rocky shores. No mountains gleam with snow. No bears prowl. It is a settled region, marked everywhere by human presence. But for all our buildings and lights and roads, for all our signs and words, that human presence is only a thin film stretched over mystery. Let sunlight flame in a blade of grass. Let night come on. These are all the parts of wilderness, sunlight, night. Let thunder roar and tornado whirl. Let the earth quake. Let muscles twitch. Let mind curl about the least pebble or blossom or bird and the true wildness of this place, of all places, reveals itself. I believe we can only be adequate to the earth if we are adequate to our neighborhoods. At the same time, we can live wisely in our chosen place only if we recognize its connections to the rest of the planet. The challenge is to see one's region as a focus of processes that extend over the earth and out to the edges of the universe. To realize that this place is only one of an infinite number of places where the powers of nature show forth. And finally, the work of belonging to a place is never finished. There will always be more to know than any mind or lifetime can hold. But that is no argument against learning all one can. So today we'll learn something about it. It's really a wonderful book. If anybody wants to borrow it, if you can't find it, I'm happy to stick it in the library temporarily. It goes long. So what is the Chicago region? I told Tygan, I'm really used to doing talks with PowerPoint, so I'm stretching here. You're going to have to, like, I'm going to tell you things are beautiful, and you're going to have to trust me on that, and I'm going to, like, try to tell you what the... So I am going to talk about the city of Chicago, but in a lot of senses, I also want to talk about our whole region at the southern end of Lake Michigan here. So this six-county region that includes Lake County, DuPage County, Will County, et cetera, a little bit over into northwestern Indiana, the Dunes National Park, a little bit up into southwest Wisconsin, Shewaukee Prairie. That's sort of a natural boundary of a beautiful part of this planet that we live in. And the organizations that are working together in this consortium called Chicago Wilderness are sort of spread all over that region. And I wanted to talk, you know, so how do you understand a region? You really want to know a little bit about how it got here. And So I'm going to start, I'm going to dwell on it, but I'm going to start way back when there was a glacier here receding 14,000 years ago, because our landscape was created by that ice. Our landforms were created by that ice. Ridge Avenue is a result of a ridge that the glacier left. Lake Michigan is a result of that. When that glacier receded, animals, of course, moved in. Plants moved in. That's what nature did. People moved in as well. Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm really bad with numbers.
Yes.
But did you say 14,000 years ago?
14,000 years ago is when there were four major glaciations on this continent, and 14,000 years ago is when the last one receded. So that's the last time there was a mile of ice right here where we're sitting.
That's pretty recent.
It's very recent. So we live in that's exactly right. This is a very new landscape, and it was created by that ice, and it was also created by fire. Fire and ice, how much more exciting could you get than that? Because what happened is, after the glaciers left, as I said, the plants and animals moved in. The climate changed gradually. It got warmer, it got a little drier, and people came in, and the people that came in, they came in following the game. They were hunting people, so they came in following the game that supported their life. But they managed this landscape with fire. People all over the globe manage landscapes with fire. There's actually another book that I should put on here that's back in the kitchen called Fire in America by Stephen Pine. He's not an ecologist. He's a historian. He's just brilliant. He talks about all the cultural uses of fire, but that's too... can't go into that now or we'll never get done. Anyway, but the fire had a big impact on the landscape. And so a lot of our communities, a lot of our natural communities, like this beautiful prairie that's on front of this, or this beautiful prairie, these are fire-dependent communities. They were created by fire, and the plants and animals that live there not only are fire-tolerant, they require fire in order to thrive. So we live in a fire-dependent community. That's a little bit of the sort of the natural history of what got here. What I want to say now is a little bit about the human history, and it's not going to go nearly as far as the European human history. We talked about the native history. So Europeans started coming, well, I'll just say it. So 2,000 years ago, there were big, I don't want to call them cities, but there were lots of people here. It's sort of a misunderstanding that there weren't that many people here. So there were big settlements, but the way people lived on the landscape was not the way we live on the landscape, and it's what we would call now, although there's a lot of judgment in this, more compatible with the landscape. So I don't go into too much detail about that, because then the anthropologists will want to talk about it for a long time. When Europeans came, they at first sort of adopted that same kind of lifestyle as fur trappers, largely the French, and the Native Americans lived fairly compatibly together. It was not until the War of 1812, this is where there won't be a quiz, but you could write it down. You want to know if there are any facts. This is part of the Northwest Territory, and control got turned over to the U.S. government. What did the U.S. government do? They sent out the land surveyors, who literally walked every mile with their chains, measuring it, mapping it, so that it could be sold and the land could be settled. And very quickly after that, those are the 1830s, very quickly after that, in 75 years, like a lifetime, a human lifetime, there were 2 million people here. It's just amazing to think about. That part of it is the location, 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 the way the realtors talk about it. That this was the place where you could come from the East Coast through the St. Lawrence Seaway, you could get here, and then the very short portage, walk your canoe over to the rivers and get over to the Mississippi River and down to the Gulf of Mexico. So they, I think I have Nature's Metropolis on this list, right? Yeah, by William Cronin. So this was a very, very important, right where the city was, very, very important location, and the land was very very rich for agriculture. And so literally there were a million people here in the early 20th century when there had been just a few hundred, 75 or 80 years before. That, of course, gave people pause. It took a toll on the landscape. The landscape changed. What happened during that time was, number one, the fires stopped as much as people could stop them. So fire suppression was a huge effort by the people here. And the other major, from the landscape's point of view, catastrophe was drainage started. This is a very, very wet landscape. In fact, I should have mentioned the beavers when I was talking about what formed our landscape. Fire and ice and beavers, I should say. I mean, the beavers are just unbelievable in terms of moving the waterways around, removing trees, just spectacular landscape alterers. In the early part of the 20th century, people started thinking about this place in a more thoughtful way. They wanted to be more thoughtful about how this place should grow. It had just grown like that without any thought about where should people go or how should they plan it. So if you listen to WBEZ, which I'm sure many of you do, I see, you have heard about, this is the centennial of Daniel Burnham's plan of Chicago. It's been really hammered home to us just about 20 times a day on the radio and lots of other places. In the early part of the 20th century, I just wanted to read a little quote from Daniel Burnham. He didn't write the plan of Chicago. He assembled a lot of pieces together into this plan for Chicago. And it wasn't just Chicago. It was a much larger region, went all the way to Rockford, went all the way to the Dunes. It was the Chicago region. He said, "The people of Chicago have ceased to be impressed by rapid growth or the great size of the city. What they insist on asking now is, how are we living?" And so that was his way of thinking about what should we do for the plan of Chicago. And the reason this is important when we're talking about wilderness is one of the most important legacies of the plan of Chicago is all of the spectacular undeveloped land that we have right here, very close to where we are now. So there was this, they should be much more famous than they are. They call themselves, they were assembled by an architect named Dwight Perkins. He lived in Evanston, and he has many, many things to his credit. I can recommend a biography of him. I don't know the name, but you'll have to Google it. But also he has a son, who's another brilliant guy. He had this thing on Sunday afternoons at his house, and he had just invited smart, wonderful people to it, and they called themselves the Committee on the Universe. And wonderful. I always wanted to reassemble the Committee on the Universe. And they just thought up great ideas, and they had people in it like Jens Jensen, the Danish landscape architect who was responsible. Coming from Europe, he saw our landscape in the way people here didn't quite see it, the way outsiders often could see things that you don't see what's right in front of you. Jane Addams was on the Committee of the Universe. I mentioned this morning that today's her birthday, and she's one of my favorite people ever because she, in all of her work in settlement houses, also did things like had fresh air camps for the people that were, she was working with the poorest of the poor immigrants and gave them art and nature as well as food and, ABCs because she really was feeding all parts of these people. She's a spectacular woman. Anyway, the Committee on the Universe is who thought up the forest preserves, and Dwight Perkins, who is good friends with Daniel Burnham. So that got embedded in the plan for this region, and the way they talked about it was, we need this for the people here. People can't live here without nature. It would not be a worthwhile life without nature. And so in 1913, Illinois passed this law that is unique in our country. It's a law that the enabling legislation for the forest preserves in our state. And that law said that county government could tax itself to purchase and hold land with a conservation mission. Had just never been heard of before. In 1915, 2 years after the legislation, the Cook County Forest Preserve District established itself and bought 600 acres of land in Deer Grove. And now, 68,000 acres of land is owned by the County of Cook. That is 11% of the surface area of the county that has the biggest city in the Midwest. Fully 11% of it is owned by us, the public, with a conservation mission. It's a truly stupendous fact that if you ask 10 people walking down the street, I sort of guess probably none of them would really know it. But if you pay real estate taxes, if you're a homeowner or you're a renter, you still pay real estate taxes just indirectly, you'll notice that there's a little line item in there for Forest Preserve District. Forest Preserve District is managed by county government, the same ones that do the jail and the hospital and so forth. But they reassemble as the Forest Preserve District Commissioners, and they have a big budget. Well, not big enough really to, I'm getting into that, 68,000 acres. I think on my bill it's like $24 or something. I'd gladly pay 10 times more, but anyway. So all the counties around here now, DuPage County started theirs a couple months later, and Will has one, and McHenry has a conservation district, which is technically different, but basically the same. Lake has a wonderful one. And those county forest preserve districts, which has people taxing themselves to buy and hold land for conservation purpose, is really the basis of a very significant conservation land holding. And when I say very significant, I don't mean locally significant. So now I can put on my my authority hat. So I used to work for the Nature Conservancy before I worked for the Field Museum. I've only been at the Field Museum for the last 5 years. And the Nature Conservancy is a science-based organization that really looks at natural areas all over the world and assigns ranks to them. There's global ranks that are called the G ranks, and then there's S ranks, which are more local. I forget what S stands for, probably state. Anyway, there are many globally, one and two. There's five ranks, with five being the most common and one being the most rare. There are many globally one and two communities right here, because this landscape is unique on the globe and we have little patches of it left. So if we're going to save this stuff, it has to be saved here. So it's a very important thing we're doing for global conservation here in the Chicago region, having these thousands of acres of wilderness. And total in the region, that big region that I described, is 360,000 acres. That's a lot.
Just to clarify,
yeah.
You said this is the state of Illinois, so those the areas in Wisconsin and Indiana you were including,
yes,
not have this kind of conservation?
They don't. The natural areas that are in the Chicago wilderness region in Indiana and Wisconsin, in Indiana, it's the dunes, that's a national park. In Wisconsin, it's a big state park. So those two states, no other state has county-level forest preserve districts. Now, they have other kinds of parks and stuff, and you know, other states have done other things to protect, but Illinois was really the earliest and the most, I think, original in terms of how directly effective it could be. Here's a number that'll stun you. You know, these places have budgets, but if they want to buy more land, they have to go to the voters with a referendum and get it voted in. And you know, you've heard about school districts getting their referenda voted down and so forth. In the last 10 years, in the five, not Cook County, they haven't had a referendum, but the other five collar counties, voters have voted to tax themselves over $1 billion in the last 10 years for land acquisition because they like it so much. And it's passed with like 68%, 69%. One of them in Lake County was 71%. So it's a very cool thing because the people that live there can decide they want it and they'll pay for it and then it just goes forward. So it's really good, system. So that's all the good news. So what's the problem? Why do we need conservation? So it's important to know we have 360,000 acres. It's not one big preserve. It's in some big, some large green spots all over the place in this region, disconnected. And there are problems with that. There are, so we always talk about threats. That's the way a conservation world talks about what we need to do. So there's been six important threats that everyone agrees on in this region that are things that we need to do something about if we want this important resource to thrive in the long run. So we're talking about long-term viability. In 100 years, will it be here? In 300 years, will it be here? It's going to be there next year, but the planet's going to be here for a lot longer than we're going to be here. Invasive species, you've heard about that. Invasive species, they come in plant form, they come in animal form, they come in disease form. This is a real problem, and it's something we need to think about what to do about. I'm not going to talk about the solutions right now. Just sort of list these. Fragmentation, just the very fact that these things are little islands, and some of the islands are only a few acres. Now, some of them are relatively large. I'm going to tell you about, 11-acre ones and then 15,000-acre ones. But because they're fragmented, simple things like pollen can't get from one to another to make sure there's genetic viability, and then more complicated things. So fragmentation is a big one. Hydrologic alteration is huge. So everything from paving to ditching of rivers to like dams, we have surpassed the beavers in hydrologic alteration in our that landscape that I was talking about before the Europeans got here was a very dynamic landscape. Those streams moved around, the wetlands moved around. We need everything to stay where it is because we've developed everything around it. So hydrologic alteration is a big one. Incompatible development, meaning we still are putting buildings and other things on places like floodplains that really hurt the natural processes. And then the last one is interesting of the six threats to local biodiversity. It's the lack of public understanding of all of these. We need. That's why I was willing to come here today. Well, I hope you'll go out and preach next week. I don't mean preach in that sense. I mean spread the word. We need political will if we're going to make this happen. And the fact that most people aren't aware that it's even here, let alone that there are issues that need to be attended to, some of them very urgently. So lack of public understanding, that's one of the reasons that this magazine was developed. Of course, the trick is to get it in the hands of people that aren't already, the choir. But so those are the six threats. So now I just say a little bit about what we're doing here. Yes?
I got five of them.
Oh, what did I leave out? Oh, I left one out there.
Invasive species, fragmentation, hydrologic alteration.
I know which one I left out. Fire suppression.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we don't have fire in these fire-dependent communities has meant that a lot of them have become less healthy. Even though they're protected, they're legally protected, and nothing, bad, quote, can happen to them. In a prairie, if a prairie doesn't have fire, what happens is woody growth comes in there. Fire kept out a lot of these woody shrubs. Those things get big. They create shade. Prairie plants are so tough, they can handle just about anything. They cannot handle shade. And then the prairie dies under the shade. So the fire comes in there, and the fire keeps the woody stuff out, keeps the sunshine coming in, because the sunshine is what these things need, basically, to eat. I mean, that's how they make their living, right? They turn sunshine into carbohydrate, and they eat it, and then we eat them. So that's how the world goes around. So fire suppression was a really big one. A lot of these things we know about, and we now, the conservation world, are working on. So the landowners, now understand that fire suppression is a bad thing and are trying to invest in more fire management, and that is happening. People are trying to reverse the effects of hydrologic alteration. The Army Corps, which got our billions of dollars to do bad things, is now getting a lot more billions of dollars to undo some of the things they did. Some of the rivers that they ditched, they're re-meandering, and that's all good. So there's a lot of good stuff happening. And in our region, there's a very effective and well-respected and well-thought-of consortium of conservation groups, large and small, called Chicago Lowlands. It's actually officially called the Chicago Region Biodiversity Council, but no one ever remembers that, and we always call it Chicago Wilderness. But another important thing that I wanted to just say is that a level of conservation work that's happening in our region is happening with grassroots, and that we're almost sort of famous for it, that there's been some books written by it. Stephanie Mills is one of the people that's written about it. She has a book called In Service of the Wild. She has quite a lot of other things that she's written, and Jerry Sullivan wrote a lot about it in his columns in The Reader, and there are a lot of columns about it. Right now it's formally called the Volunteer Stewardship Network, which makes it sound like it's a really formal organization. It's very, very grassroots, very decentralized, very focused on small groups of people doing important things at a particular place that they are taking care of. And the kinds of things that they're doing are things to abate these threats. So, for example, removing invasive species is something that a lot of people just take for granted that they're going to do every Saturday and Sunday, or every Sunday, or, you know, every Thursday night in the summer when the sun doesn't go down until 9 o'clock. Replanting some of the areas, so collecting seeds and replanting areas that have been shaded out and now, you know, have been burned, so we can get those plants back in there. Growing plants in their own backyard of these native genotypes and then collecting those seeds and giving them back to the Forest Preserve District or the land manager so they can be planted. Teaching children in a program called the Mighty Acorns, which gets kids out to do stewardship, so working on that last thread of building public understanding. So I thought I would tell you about a few places, some very close to here, where people are doing just that, tell you what they're doing, and sort of invite you to find out more about it. You may be interested, you may not be interested, you may know people that are interested. At the very least, if you ever hear about this, or if you ever have a meeting with, like, the president or your senator, you could say how great this stuff is, because we really do need to build official support for this. So the first one I wanted to mention is right over at Montrose Beach. Have you been there to the dune that formed? So about, I don't know, a dozen years ago or so, some people convinced that's the biggest public beach on the lakeshore. And you know that open lakefront is one of the other legacies of the Plan of Chicago. So it's one of the ones more people know about than some of the other ones. So Montrose Beach is the biggest public beach in the city. And about a dozen years ago or so, a few people convinced the park district, which manages that beach, to stop grooming it. Now, grooming means they take big machines and they flatten the sand, because that's what you want for a beach where people are going to, you know, go swimming and put their towel down and whatever. Just for a small area, it's a big, big beach, just for a small area, they stopped doing that. They fenced it off, and it was an experiment. And what do you think happened? And nature did its thing. What happens on beach? The sand blows, it hits a little twig or a little blade of grass, it starts building up. A dune grew on this spot in just a few years. Every year it gets a little bigger. It's got a foredune now, and it's a real natural area. In fact, it officially was declared, I think in 2005, by the state natural areas inventory. It has been put on the state's natural areas inventory. It is nature. This was all created by a woman named Leslie Borns, who in her real life is an editor. That's, you know, what she does for a living. She's a bird watcher. She used to always bird down at Montrose Beach. She was one of the people that convinced the park district to stop grooming it and convinced a lot of the dog walkers to not walk their dogs over there and convinces people to come once a month and work on it. So people go there, I think it's once a month. They have a official morning where people are either planting plants or collecting seeds or pulling weeds or whatever and taking care of that dune. So it's only 11 acres, but it's really high profile. I mean, how many people go there? And they've put up interpretive signing. So not only is it providing habitat, it's also providing public education. So that's Montrose. Another one that's a particular favorite of mine and is really nearby here, and Tigan and I had talked about maybe the Sangha going and doing some stewardship someday, and this might be a place we would go. It's a group called Riverbank Neighbors, and I just wanted to read what it says on their website. It says, "We are a community united by our work as stewards of the river in our neighborhood." And it's basically the stretch of the Chicago River from Montrose to Berteau, not very far. And it's been pretty much, they work with the Water Reclamation District and figured out the sort of politics of how they can get, you know, the authority to go in there and work. It's just magnificent. It's completely revegetated with native plants. There's a beautiful trail. There's a little twig fence. And they're out there pretty much, different neighbors are out there all the time, but they have official work days every couple of months, every couple of weeks, depending on the time of year. I don't usually work with Riverbank Neighbors, but I do sing with a group of Riverbank Neighbors called the Bullfrogs. So we serenade the community at community block parties and stuff like that. And, you know, Lisa Madigan lives in that neighborhood, and she is not an insignificant person, and she knows about Riverbank Neighbors. And so if she knows about Riverbank Neighbors, then her dad, Michael Madigan, probably knows about Riverbank Neighbors. Maybe even Blagojevich knows about Riverbank Neighbors, but he didn't have much influence these days. She's the state's attorney general, and she's a terrific person. And she has two adorable little kids that she loves to bring down there because it's a wonderful experience for them. When before the Riverbank Neighbors were doing this work, it was sort of a scary place down there. It's like you didn't want to go down by the river because you, heaven only knows what can happen to, you know, it's like a maybe perception, maybe reality, maybe some combination of those two. So, so those are two really close by, and those are two places that I would say are really real. Habitat, even from the point of view of the Nature Conservancy, there are natural communities there of value to the biodiversity on the planet. So going a little farther away, there's a forest preserve district at the entrance to it is at like Foster and near the expressway. I think I wrote down the cross street. It's just this side of Pulaski. Yeah, pretty close to Pulaski. Oh, you know, I skipped one. Let me do North Park Village. I should look at my notes because I'm probably leaving out all kinds of cool stuff, but I hate to read. So North Park Village is an interesting place. That is at Pulaski and Peterson. And it used to be the Metropolitan Tuberculosis Sanitarium. And interestingly enough, I used to work there, so in the 70s and 80s, when it was a sanitarium, it was the same mindset as those people I was talking about, the Committee on the Universe and the Plan of Chicago people. The guy that was in charge of the sanitarium really thought nature was the way to heal people with tuberculosis. This was before they had a lot of drugs. He went out of his way to landscape this and restore it and manage it in a way that people had. They had a pond to walk to, they had a sugar bush to do maple syrup, they had a beautiful garden, rock garden. Just that was the idea of a healing thing for people. Well, of course, treatment of tuberculosis changed as they got better or more direct cures than that. And so the Tipi Sanitarium closed down in, I think, 1973. And the very next thing that was going to happen is it was going to be developed, and they were going to call that development Green Acres. They were like, pave it? It sounds like one of those folk songs, doesn't it? So Melvina Reynolds could write a good folk song on that. Anyway, so the community wouldn't have it, though. The community really objected to this beauty, because it was a beautiful green. It's 160 acres in the city of pretty much open space on the northwest side of the city. When it first got put there, it was like so far out of the city, but then the city, of course, grew up, and there it was in the city. So they luckily had an influential person in their neighborhood, Seymour Simon, who I think was alderman then, but he went on to be on the state Supreme Court. And they organized, and they actually defeated one of the very few defeats that our current mayor's father received, was that North Park Village did not get developed. And it's a multi-use site. It has a Chicago Park District. It's managed by the Park District. It has housing for senior citizens. It has one little corner has some condominiums because they needed some income to come to it. But it's got two natural areas and a wonderful nature center, and it serves lots of school children all year long and has lots of public programs and also has a group of stewards. So North Park Village is one of those good news stories that sort of fun to think about. Could have just been another 7-Eleven or whatever. It would have been a Target or something. The Audubon Society had their office there for many years, and they did birdwalks there all the time and have a really, really complete list of all the birds that use that place. So all of these places I'm sort of talking about from a human perspective, but all of these places are habitat for many, many other of the plants and animals that we share this region with. It's funny, when I worked there, we used to have these bird walks on Saturday morning, and they're beginner bird walks. They're for people who wanted to learn about birds but didn't really have much experience. And this is a really common thing to happen. So we'd take them out and we'd show them all the birds, and they really like it. And they'd come back the next week for, you know, another week of birding. They'd say, "It's so amazing. There didn't used to be birds in my neighborhood, but now there are." Because they weren't noticing them. It happened over and over again. So I always loved that. I always remembered it. It's like if you teach someone what to look for, they actually will get a lot more pleasure out of being in their own neighborhood. So anyway, so I started talking about this place. It's got three different names. The place, Sauganash is one name for it. Labal Woods is probably the most common name for it. But the Irene Hernandez Picnic Area is what it says on the most noticeable sign. And Forest Preserve District, for all their good things that they do, tends to name their places after either battles or politicians. So it's like Bunker Hill, Woods, and anyway. So I don't know who Irene Hernandez was, but she got this area named after her. That's a wonderful place for walking along the river. It's one of the richest floodplain woodland areas anywhere nearby, especially if you go in the springtime, but really during the entire growing season. You'll just see a host of gorgeous flowers, and I don't know if this is where I wish I had my pictures to show you, and you're going to have to take my word for it, but like Dutchman's Breeches. Have people heard of Dutchman's Breeches? People think this is a little, pretty little plant that comes up in the spring, and the flower, it's a little bit like Bleeding Heart, if you know the garden plant Bleeding Heart. Anyway, it's such a complicated flower. It looks like upside down pair of those breeches that, is Dutchman a slur? I suppose. Anyway, didn't mean it that way. Anyway, that's a really rare plant, and there it is right in Chicago at Sauganash. Larry Hodak is the steward of that site, so he's another person. He lives right on, I think, Sacramento, around Montrose. He's an architect, and for the last 30 years, he's been taking care of that place and has work days there quite regularly. Bunker Hill Prairie, up on the between Devon and Caldwell and Toohey, is managed by a couple named John and Jane Balaban. Jane's a pharmacist at Evanston Hospital, and John's a science teacher at St. Ignatius College Prep, and they spend a lot of their time managing that site at Bunker Hill Prairie, and they have turned into some really expert botanists, just completely self-taught. And I know that because I work at the Field Museum with botanists that all have PhDs from Princeton and so forth, and they will call them up and say, do you know where I can find? So it's really, it's one of the pleasures of being involved in the landscape, and one of the things that Sanders mentioned is learning about it. And just as the people who didn't know, you know, that had a neighborhood with no birds one week and birds the next week, the more you know about these things, the more richness you have in your life. So I want to talk about two big places, one on either end of the region, just because I just don't think people know about them or think to go there. The Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore is a national park. Chicagoans, almost no Chicagoans use it. They go to Glacier and Yellowstone and places in California. And I'm not saying don't go to Glacier and Yellowstone, don't go to the Canadian Rockies. Those places are really, really wonderful. But this is our landscape, and it's only an hour and a half from here. It's 15,000 acres. It's one of the richest botanically national parks in the whole system. And they have lots of opportunities for people to interact with it. But one of the coolest things they have is this thing called the Dunes Learning Center, which is just a few little cabins in the woods, basically. But it's for kids of all ages, from whoever wants to come, for a very low price, get to go and camp in a national park. And they do thousands of kids every year. And we send a lot of the kids, now I'm talking about Field Museum's education program, we send a lot of our kids from the innerest of the inner city, you know, kids that really don't get a chance to get much off their own block, down there for a summer camp experience, and it's really transformative, and it's a wonderful, wonderful resource to have here. And then at the very other end, way up in southwest Wisconsin, or actually just on this side of the border, is Illinois Beach State Park. And Illinois Beach State Park has beautiful dunes, beautiful prairies, beautiful woodlands. It has the only, oh, here's a good fact. It has the only river in Illinois that still flows into Lake Michigan, called the Dead River, because we've reversed the Chicago River, of course, and we've reversed the Calumet River, and those both go, you know, down to the Gulf of Mexico. But the Dead River is still going, you know, still draining into the lake. And Illinois Beach has many, many public programs. One of the ones I was going to mention is a thing called Snoopin' for Lupin. So lupin is a flower, and it happens to be a flower that a federally endangered butterfly called the Karner Blue Butterfly must have in order to have its life cycle. The caterpillar of the Karner Blue Butterfly can only eat, in nature's interesting world, can only live if it eats lupin. And so if you don't have lupin, you don't have the Karner Blue Butterfly. So there's a beautiful natural area, has lots of habitat for lots of things, but this particular butterfly needs that plant. So they've got volunteers that are out there finding all the lupins and collecting the seeds and multiplying the supplies of lupins, yes, so that we'll have the butterfly.
I know that flower doesn't happen. It grows vociferously at Tassajara.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if it's the same.
I think there's another blue butterfly out there. So Karner Blue is local to here, but I think there's a rare Western blue. Yeah, blues are a group of butterflies. They're beautiful, beautiful, again, show you the slide sometime. Beautiful bright blue butterflies. So that's basically all I wanted to say. This morning Tigan gave a wonderful talk, and he quoted Gary Snyder. And Gary Snyder, I should say that everything by Gary Snyder and everything by Wendell Berry should be on here. So just take that for granted. I just didn't have room for all that. But you could just write everything by those two people. And so I just have one little quote from Gary Snyder, who I've learned so much from. I wish I would meet him one day. And he's just talking about the relationship of the Native people in his part of the world to the landscape and in near history. The landscape was intimately known, and the very idea of community and kinship embraced, and that included the huge populations of wild beings. And so many words in there that make tears come to my eyes, that community and kinship would include the wild beings. It's powerful and important. Anyway, I only have one other thing to say. I'm advertising a play, an original play about a plant. It's free. It's on the south side. The plant is called Bismia americana. It was only found in the Calumet wetlands in 1917, 18, and 19, and then a building was built on that spot, and it's never been seen again. And anyway, it's a wonderful story written by a local woman named Chris Hodak, who's actually married to that architect, Larry Hodak, who's the steward. So thank you all for your attention. I'd love to hear your thoughts, and I'd love to hear other places that you want to share with other people. And if you ever want to go out and do any of this stuff, call me up. Yes?
All kinds of things came to mind as you were talking, but I have to start with. Through Sierra Club, volunteering, they have projects. They teamed up with Leslie Bourne, and so I've been involved in that.
Oh, great.
Pollinating invasive plants two or three times. And that is amazing to me because it seems like by the energy of one person starting it, something really fantastic is changing. And also, the last year they pointed out that a number of new species of birds that were native to this area a few hundred years ago are coming back.
Yes.
And then the falcon followed it because they prey on some of these small lizards.
Yes.
So there's a whole process happening there.
Yeah, it was a big hubbub in the birding community this year because the piping plovers nested for the first time in 40 years. It was a big secret. You couldn't tell anybody. They nest on the ground, so you have to really be careful. But anyway, that was a really big deal. It is a really big deal. And now we can talk about it.
Yeah.
Piping plovers.
The other thing is that in the very recent National Geographic, there was a story about before New York, and it describes in the 1700s, people have gone back and researched what it looked like. And so first of all, you can look and see, and they've done it by looking at what are the natural things there now and trying to go back and figure out what was native and what was not. And that's fascinating because you can look up addresses and they're hypothesizing.
Right.
But they told a little story of a beaver that's come up the river and on its own outside of the zoo recently and began building a dam, and one hasn't been seen for a few hundred years. And it did talk about how they completely changed the landscape. But it was fascinating just to imagine a city that is all completely concrete,
mm-hmm.
or most of it, and what it was like and the fact that that happened in about 300-400 years.
Well, one advantage that we have over places in the country that were not part of the Northwest Territory is that we have the land surveyor's notes. We still have them. They hand wrote them, and you can get them online. And you can actually look. And they wrote down, and they had chains that were, they literally walked and wrote the vegetation that they saw. And they had to, at every corner, and they do mile things and then quarter section, at every corner, they had to put a mark, slash a tree, you could still find a lot of those.
Wow.
And they had to write what exactly was there. And they would say, swamp white oak, and they listed all, and some of them were better than others.
Sure.
There was a guy in Lake County that wrote things wasn't very good, but anyway, like anything else, people are, but we can still get them, and so a lot of people, of all the conservation work, refers to the land surveyor's notes, and they've actually made maps of the vegetation based on the land surveyor's notes. That's the pre-settlement. And so you can see exactly where the smaller communities were. And of course, I said, and I stand by it, this is a dynamic landscape. So this was a snapshot of where it was in the 1830s, and doesn't mean that this is what it will always be or what it even should be, but it gives us a lot of information. Mm-hmm. And so some counties, we have more information than others, like Lake County did a really detailed map, and King County did a less detailed map. But yeah, it's really, I think doing that, it's against sort of the public awareness and the public, you know, tugging on the public's heart to help them see why should they care about this. And so they really do connect with something like that.
Right, that it was rich and beautiful, yeah. And we go other places to see that,
yeah.
And realizing,
yeah,
that was here.
Central Park has a really devoted group of bird watchers that's out there every morning, and a lot of them are the people on Wall Street and the people on, you know, Madison Avenue and all the, you know, the people making those $1 million salaries that we hear about. That, but they have this little sort of, it's a secret society because anyone knows about it, but it really is sort of secret because most people don't pay attention to it. It's before the real world starts, and they have lots and lots of good information about Central Park from those people.
That's right. Yeah, stewards of it. Yeah,
yeah, they are. Yeah. There's a Central Park Conservancy.
I have sort of three things, two of them are a question. The first one is, you mentioned this Committee on the Universe.
Yeah.
And I don't know too much about it, but maybe you do. You know about these events that are happening at Hull House now? I think on Wednesdays and or Thursday around noon, there are open lunches.
Those lunches, yeah.
Yeah, and I think they're largely involved, I haven't been able to attend yet, but they're largely concerned with issues of local food,
yeah.
and that kind of thing,
yeah.
Beekeeping. But I think that also branches out into broader environmental concerns. And if people such as you, you know, I think would be very welcome to make, I think they often have sort of a presentation to the hinge things around, and they're open to the, you know, the public. They sound like really great events. So I don't know if you can fill that out any, but.
Well, I would, just about the local food issue, it's been one of the revelations of the last 5 years to the conservation world. At the time this was created in 1996, neither climate change nor food issues was on anybody's radar screen. If you had brought that up in a meeting, they were just like, that's irrelevant, that's go away, we're talking about something else. But in the last 5 years or so, I don't want to talk about climate change, this is a big can of, but the idea of our food is so important for so many reasons. Land use is a big part of it. You know, a big part of the outside of this region is now agricultural. It's going to change, and it's either going to be something bad, like those horrible housing developments that, you know, with 5 acres of turf grass, or it could change from corn and soybeans to food that feeds our region. Not only would that be healthier, think of all the fuel that would get saved. You know, it's a big conservation issue, and there's a lot of people working really hard to do that. I think the emphasis at Hull House is more in getting food to people in the city that have no access to food, because, you know, people use the word food desert for so many of our communities where people buy groceries at a 7-Eleven instead of a, you know, a real grocery store. And they're trying to get farmers markets and so forth. But yeah, food's a very big deal.
The other two things that are more questions, one has to do with what you think the impact would be if the Olympics were to come here on, for example, Washington Park, Jackson Park, some of those kinds of things. This is one of the, yeah.
It's not on tape. Field Museum is officially in favor of the Olympics. But.
The third one is, there was this issue that came up in my neighborhood a few years ago, maybe five, well, maybe as long ago as 8 or 9 years ago, with beavers suddenly reappearing in Jackson Park. Mm-hmm. And sort of what to do about that? Because, I mean, one response was like, you know, it was really exciting to like go for a walk and see a beaver dam going up. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, they took down, you know, hundreds of trees along the lagoon there, and they were eventually removed. But so there's this issue of like, you know, letting sort of nature sort of reassert itself as it will versus some kind of management.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could say something about
that. I will say something about management. I have to say beavers are a little bit of a thorny issue and we don't have it all figured out, but management is absolutely necessary in the face of all these threats that I mentioned. You cannot, well, first of all, people have been in nature, so we are in nature anyway, but so you shouldn't say nature and then without people. But in terms of actual active management, it needs it. It needs us to use what we call prescribed fire, because we can't wait around for lightning, and we need the fire to be in place in ways that it's safe for development. We need to manage deer, because there are too many deer in this landscape for the landscape to survive, and we've taken away all the predators. The only predator on deer in this region is the car, which is not a good way to manage deer, either for people or for deer. And so we need to figure that out. We need to manage for things like Canada geese, which we've created this huge habitat for with these sprawling developments with the way they handle water. So these are all things that are sort of problems that humans have created, or at least mostly created. So we do need to manage them. Beavers are interesting, though. They're pretty unmanageable. I mean, you have to remove them. They're relentless. I mean, they're really amazing. They're a lot like people. So, I'm not a wildlife biologist. I know wildlife biologists are thinking really hard about it. You know, we get these extraordinary circumstances in the city, like that cougar that was pretty close to here. When was that, last year? That
a couple
course.
Years ago, yeah, it was a few blocks from where I lived.
Yeah.
They just captured us in Seattle this morning.
Yeah. Oh. So some of that is sort of anomalous. Some of that, though, we're going to have more of, because we do have more and better natural areas. We are providing habitat. It's sort of like build it and they will come. We didn't used to have coyotes here 20 years ago. I remember a coyote being killed by a car in the Palos region, way southwest part of the county, about 20 years ago. It being a huge deal. It's like everybody was calling everybody a coyote. Where did it come from? Now they're everywhere.
I was on a bike trail in Columbia Woods last Sunday, and all of a sudden there was all this ruckus, and my friends told me there was a pack of coyote that weren't all that far from us. And I was
yeah, it's interesting. We're going to have to think about ways to live harmoniously with them. I mean, I believe we should treasure much of it, but we need to think about all the implications of it, and it really just means thinking about it without sort of, in my view anyway, thinking it without the sort of exterminator mindset, because we've already been through the exterminator phase and we didn't like it.
The coyotes in our neighborhood actually take down deer in the winter.
Yeah.
I mean, most say they don't, but I'm across the street from it, and they do.
They do, yeah. They take the weaker ones, the smaller ones. They take the young.
Yes, take the ones, yeah.
And, so in some cases, the more complex the system gets, the more it sort of, you know, sort of balances itself. But a lot of stuff's been out of whack for a while, and so things don't get really healthy really fast. And so there's a lot of transition. There's also a lot of unknowns. There's really just a lot of stuff we don't know at all. What is throwing the conservation world into a complete tizzy right now, and this is not an understatement, global climate change is It's just a complete game changer. I don't know how to say it. We've been figuring out how to restore these areas for the last 30 years. We pretty much know how to do it. Now they're going to move north. They're going to move north. Like, how could a fen move north? A fen is based on geochemical properties. You know, it's got to have alkaline water. It's, you know, it can't move north. It's just all completely baffling, and people are studying it like crazy, but mostly people are worried. It's very, very troubling. There was an article in Science Magazine, which is probably the most well-regarded scientific publication, that was really talking about we're not going to have the natural communities that we know anymore. Everything's going to reassemble, and we're going to have new stuff to deal with. And that's probably right. I mean, how do you plan for that?
I mean, it has to be, right?
I think you have to be a Zen student. It's just really, really, really major, big deal. So, I don't know. I guess we do what's in front of us, and then see.
Well, kind of in response to your whole presentation and from the heart about that, maybe this time we have a little bit more respect for that process too, and we'll be part of it in a different way.
I
think that's part of our work.
I hope so.
I just want to say how informative and much I appreciate, you know, your talk. A lot of which I didn't know about anyway, and you mentioned Gary Snyder, and I talked about some things from Practice of the Wild, which is a wonderful book. His last book is, I forget the exact title, but something about fire.
Yes,
I
just bought it.
Yeah, it's a really wonderful book. I read it and I haven't, but I forget the. But this
it's like
book,
Back from Fire or something like that.
Something like that, Back from Fire. Anyway, wonderful book of essays, but I did not know about the fire suppression aspect of this ecosystem, and that's fascinating. And I'm not exactly sure what my question is, but I understand what you're saying about the prairie needing fire to destroy the wooded growth so that the sun comes in and so forth.
Same in the woodland, by the way. What happens in the woodlands is slightly different, but pretty much the same. So woodlands were usually pretty open. They used to talk about being able to drive horse and buggy through them.
Mm-hmm.
Now our woodlands are pretty much, you can't even walk through. They're very impenetrable because a lot of woody stuff has grown up. And the native peoples, that's one of the reasons they put fire in there, because they need to be able to see to hunt. They need to be able to run and see and, you know, whatever their weapons were. And so they kept it clear. That brush, again, shades out the ground vegetation. It's why you know about spring wildflowers, but you don't know about summer or fall wildflowers, because in the spring there's no leaves on the trees yet. This light can still get to the ground. You still have spring flora. But by the time summer and fall, it's too dark, and all that stuff has pretty much died off. So we have summer and fall flora too in a woodland that's been burned. So I'm sorry.
Thank you. It's the stuff that Gary talks about is more in the Sierras and
yes.
California, which is where I lived for 30 years before, a couple years ago. And there, you know, we have the sequoias, which are dependent on fire and it's here in the underbrush. But when you talk about, you know, you're talking about the six regional threats here, and fire suppression being one of them, I don't quite. How do you reinstitute fire? Right now, we have in California huge fire fires with the climate change. What does
partly
that mean
climate
here?
Change. Partly the big fires are a result of fire suppression, though, because regular fire keeps the fuel down.
Right.
Fire suppression lets the fuel build up to a time, and then you get catastrophic fire. So fire and the Forest Service and the Park Service gets that now. pointing a finger.
After Yellowstone.
After Yellowstone, that was a huge, that's exactly right, that was a huge experience, and Yellowstone is thriving now. What we do here, and one reason that we still don't have as much fire on the landscape as, you know, the experts believe we should have, it's pretty expensive because we have a lot of people here, we have a lot of valuable property here. We have to do it in small patches with equipment, with a lot of people working on it.
So control burn. Mm-hmm.
It's usually called prescribed fire, RX fire. We have to train a lot of people. We have to buy safety equipment. You wear Nomex suits. In the early days when we were first learning about fires, they'd go out there with a bandana across our mouth. Not near houses, but it was a little more informal. To get the public comfortable with it, we do overkill on all of that stuff, and that's fine because we want to do it. But then it just costs so much and it takes so much personnel that you can't. Say Cook County Forest Preserve has 68,000 acres. So of that 68,000 acres, 80% is natural area, 20% is like picnic grounds and that kind of stuff. So 80% needs fire. 80% of 68,000 acres is say 50,000 acres. Say you wanted to burn a quarter of it a year, it's 12,500 acres. If you're burning it at 100 acres a pop, there's a lot of people to go out there. You only have a window of a couple of weeks when the weather is good. You know, you need it to be not too warm, not too cold, not too humid, not too dry, whatever. Every year is different. You get maybe a month in the fall, maybe 6 weeks in the spring. You're not going to get 12,500 acres because it's not in one big patch. It's little things here and there. So we're not getting enough fire in the landscape, even though we know we want to, we know we should. It's just not very practical. So that's the kind of stuff we're trying to scale up.
I can't even imagine those fires in this landscape because it's so wet. I'm from California, and that dry, our manzanita and stuff goes.
Prairie fires are a spectacle. The flames can go 40 feet.
Oh.
The plants are made of fuel.
Oh,
oak leaves and the oak forest, they actually have a chemical in there that's very similar to gasoline. I mean, these things love to burn. They are fuel. And if you go on a good day, you can't go out, with 2 inches of snow on the ground. But if you go out when the conditions are right, it's like, woo! It's pretty spectacular. Yeah, I've lost my eyebrows.
That's like the story of John Muir when that tree during the storm.
The fires in L.A. are very scary. My daughter lives in L.A. She lives in East L.A. in Echo Park, and she said it's horrible. She can't breathe. Her car is covered with ash. It's just horrible.
Yeah,
sounds
we still have homes right near Echo Park, so we know it's all. We actually live on the very northern edge of Will County now.
Oh.
So I just wondered if, from your experience at the Film Museum, there's anything on the south side that you're especially proud of?
Of the south side, yes. So there's a few things. So Palos, okay, so you live in Will County, that's the teacher.
Yes.
Palos is this huge 14,000 acre complex that Cook County owns southwest. Really, really, truly wonderful. There's actual topography there.
Topography
is like snow and stuff. This actually has, you can actually walk up and walk
down. Come on.
So that's wonderful. In Will County itself, so there was a place, here's another good news story. It used to be called the Joliet Army Arsenal in Will County. And it, like many of our former military installations, was decommissioned, meaning, so there's this 28,000 acres, I believe, that had been owned by the Department of Defense, leaving out the two places that have Superfund sites on them, which is part of that, so we don't have the whole 28,000 acres. They are going to clean up those two. The rest got given to the U.S. Forest Service for the world's or the country's first national tall grass prairie called Madewin. And Madewin is a is it Potawatomi? It's one of the Native prayers, word for healing the society, which I thought was a lovely name to name because they're going to be healing it and restoring the prayer there. That has a lot of very cool things there. Yeah. They're going to build a visitor center, but they have a beautiful, beautiful garden there, because they're growing them for seeds, because they have so much to replant, and volunteers manage that garden. And they have mighty acorns there, too. But I recommend Palos. Palos is fantastic. Great for birds, great for... it's the only place I know of, it's the only place I know of in Cook County that you can get a mile away from any road. And then you look around and you don't see any like utility poles. I mean, sometimes a plane will fly over and spoil it, but you know, you get this little glimpse of what it is to be in the wilderness, as you say. It's beautiful. Lots of volunteers working down there too. You came a long way for this. Thank you.
We work in Hyde Park, so we can come in and out
regularly. The couple fix, too, you were talking, I'm so curious. Two fixes in one.
So anyway, thank you all. This was really fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come to the next one. It's going to be good, too.